Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Hello there, it's the first weekend of 2025 and welcome to the podcast. You can follow us on Spotify for this weekly selection of my favourite chats from the last couple of days. On this episode, we've a woman on tracking down her sperm donor father and her seven half-siblings, the Mayo All-Ireland star on why he chose the GAA over horses, the actor and gem of Westmeath, Mary McAvoy, strips off for a good cause. Plus, we have a selection of some of the voices we heard throughout the week from the snowed-in parts of Ireland. Priests, lifts from the army, there's something there for everyone. But first up in this podcast, Louise McLaughlin is the host of You Look Like Me, and she told me about tracking down and cold-calling her sperm donor father. She also talked about the disintegrating shame around donor-conceived children and IVF clinics, and why she's campaigning for the law to be changed in Ireland to allow for donor-conceived children to know more about where they came from and their biological parents. After that, retiring Mayo goalkeeper Rob Henley came in for a long chat about why he's stepping aside at just 34 from inter-county football to concentrate on work and family in Dublin. He also told us about the incredible demands of playing football at that level, including driving over and back from Mayo to Dublin 3 or 4 times a week to training, there and home again on the one day while continuing in his studies and in his job. Was it important that Mayo never won an All-Ireland in 7 finals? And we also chatted about the black car disaster in a replay in 2016 that nearly ended and defined his Mayo career. After Rob, actress Mary McAvoy, she is now a calendar girl. She came in to us to chat about her Jubilee year, as she's calling it, because she turned 70 last October. She also chatted about the empowerment of going to a gym in a field in Westmeath, as well as farming and living in the very house that she grew up in as an only child. And at the end, we have a collection of amazing and entertaining phone calls from people across Munster and the Midlands who are dealing with once-in-a-lifetime levels of snow this week and temperatures that reached minus 7.5. That was in Mullingar. In Charleville, the local parish priest told us it was the worst snow he's seen since 1963. We heard about the spectacular views from the Hill of Uisneach and how an Irish Army snow patrol mission helped a mother in Cork get her son to hospital for his vital dialysis treatment. There's loads of fun in this podcast, so into it we go and enjoy. For many people conceived using a donor, the pain of not knowing their biological parent or half-siblings can leave a lifelong mark. And I'm joined in the studio by Louise McLaughlin. She's a journalist and the host of the podcast You Look Like Me, it's a great name, which talks about identity issues and indeed the heart of family secrets that comes from donor conception. She is also campaigning for legal changes in Ireland so that people can identify who their biological parent is. Good morning, Louise McLaughlin.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in for this to share this story, because it is an intimate and it's a deep, meaningful conversation, really, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Before we come to that story about how you come to be born, tell us a little bit about yourself and your life today. You're a journalist.
Yes, I'm a journalist. I freelance at many, many different places. I cover normally international news. But this is a story that I found myself covering more and more in recent years. It's obviously something very personal to me, but DNA secrets, they just have so much at their heart. And I think when people hear the phrase donor conception, people can turn off because it's not a phrase that sounds necessarily interesting, but people are fascinated by DNA stories and DNA secrets.
Sure, yeah.
And all of this is at the heart, you know, who are you? Where do you come from? Who is your family? All of these things tie into this story of donor conception. And they're very, very personal for the people who are affected and people who don't actually have the answers to these questions a lot of the time.
It's extraordinary. How do you find out about your own birth? You're very young.
So I found out, I was told, when I was 13. Mm-hmm. And at the time, growing up in Ireland, I had never heard the phrase donor conception before, let alone thought that it was something that could refer to me. And it would be, you know, over a decade before I knowingly met someone who was donor conceived. Obviously, I may have come into contact with people before that, but, you know, it was not a thing that people were speaking about. If you used a donor, you didn't necessarily tell anyone, even friends, close friends, family often didn't know. And so I think growing up around that and not being kind of open necessarily with that information, It's difficult, and it is improving. People are talking about their own fertility struggles, and off the back of that, I think donor conception is becoming normalized. But it is something that donor-conceived people struggle with. They're not necessarily forthcoming about their origins. And we still exist in a situation where many parents don't actually tell their children that they are donor-conceived. So we have, you know, again, the figures, we don't actually have the exact figures, but in Ireland it is thousands, if not tens of thousands of people who are donor-conceived. Mm-hmm. Many of them, if not more than half, considerably more than half, do not know that they are donor-conceived. And we live in a situation where, you know, it's right after Christmas. People get DNA kits for fun as gifts.
They do. This is the genealogical research.
Exactly.
Finding, you know, related people, someone across the world and so on.
Yeah, exactly. People think that they're doing this to find out that, you know, a grandparent's from Scandinavia. And instead, they're finding out that actually the man who brought them up might not be their biological father. So now more than ever, as we move away from the shame and the guilt that used to be associated with donor conception, still is to a degree because it's tied in with infertility, we need honesty, because people are finding out this information just by chance, or they're being told later in life. And having spoken to many donor-conceived people, when you find out this information later in life, it pulls the rug out from underneath you. It changes everything. And people deserve to know the truth.
You find out very young, as you say. I think you're 13, you said. And like most of the, because it's fertility issues, it's people like yourself, born in the 90s. What was your reaction?
Yeah, I mean, it was a huge shock, obviously. And when you speak to people around the world who are donor conceived, we all kind of say the same thing. You know, people report looking into the mirror and just not knowing where half of them comes from. But what really was an issue for me when I found out I was donor conceived was there was no path for me to discover who my biological father was.
Right.
So,
and by the way, we should point out you're growing up in a loving, stable household.
Oh my God, my parents are absolutely amazing, and you know, I am so grateful for the fact that they told me, because the guidance at the time across the board, you know, UK, Ireland, was just don't tell. You can get away with it.
Especially, and that guidance comes from?
That was coming from clinics.
From the clinics.
Yeah, okay. That was coming from the industry. And thank God they told me, because as I just said, you know, you find this thing out later in life by chance many, many times. And it is more soul destroying when you find out by chance, because this is a conversation that needs to come from parents, I truly mm-hmm. believe. And that's what people tell me when I speak to them.
So what the crisis for you, is it an identity thing?
It's a right to information. So there are so many issues when you don't have this information. You know, there's health ramifications. If mm-hmm. you don't know you're donor conceived, you're going into a medical appointment and you're handing over false medical history. You're saying this runs in my family on this side.
I see.
And, you know, cancer is on this side, and it might not be.
You or they might be at all yeah. biologically related
yeah.
to that.
Or you're missing something that needs to be flagged. If you don't know you're donor conceived, you're handing over false information. Mm. There's also things, you know, thank God Ireland now has a limit on how many offspring can come from a donor. That wasn't always the case. You used to be able to just donate. But yeah. even still, even with a limit, donors, you know, especially sperm donors, because, you know, you can donate probably more quickly and get numbers up. You know, offspring is growing up in a small area of the same age. And if you don't know you're donor conceived, you're interacting with potential half siblings and you don't know they're your half siblings. You could be in the same school as them. You could be in the same netball team as them. Mm. I mean, it's dangerous. It's really dangerous.
You could end up dating them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I don't want to go in with scare tactics, because that's, you know, a big headline. But it does happen. And it has happened. And donor-conceived people have been interviewed having had intimate relationships with half-siblings.
This news you got at 13, it seems to change the course of your life in many ways, doesn't it? You're a journalist now. Do you think you would have become a journalist? Because it involves you set out on this path of research and tracking down your biological father.
Yeah, I definitely, I was a journalist regardless. This was not something that I spoke about. You know, I found my first match, my half sister, I think around 7-8 years ago. You know, I went through a huge chunk of life without any information. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, that was because the clinics chose not to have that available. The law now says that when you get to age 18, you can find out the identity of your donor. And that's in the UK first, that's Ireland and now followed suit. So that's since 2020.
That's quite new here, yes.
Yes. So it's new, but it's also not...
full identification of the parent?
It is, yeah. Okay. But it's also not enforced. So you think, like, that's from conceptions from 2020. So we're not going to see the impact of this law until the late 2030s.
Oh, I see. Yes, okay.
You know, and I'm here as a donor-conceived person who was deprived of information, who had to take to DNA testing sites, mm-hmm. who found my biological father around 5 years ago, and have found seven or so half-siblings since. I was forced to do that myself. I went through a decade and a half without any answers. I don't want people to have to go through that. And I think this law change in Ireland is a step in the right direction. Absolutely. But why are we depriving people of that information until they're 18? I know how it felt to sit with that information at age 13 and not have it until I was 26, you know. But the teenage years were the hardest. And I don't think that we should be inflicting, like, legally, that waiting period on donor-conceived people who, you know, ideally they would know from birth these days. That is the guidance. We would definitely recommend telling your child that they are donor-conceived from day one. If you haven't, do it today, do it tomorrow, do it as soon as possible. But with that knowledge, you're then waiting until you're 18. I've spoken to donor-conceived people who did find a biological parent, only to discover they passed away a month before they were discovered.
Really?
And this law is setting people up for those circumstances. You know, this will happen. With a law like this in place, things like that will happen. And we just need openness, honesty, identification from day one.
What about the rights of the person who've donated the sperm? Because obviously they're needed, aren't they, for people who have fertility issues?
Absolutely.
They are doing a good thing,
yeah.
Essentially.
100%.
And do they still have the right to not be found?
They are fully identifiable now. That is what they're signing
That's
up for.
Change.
The issue is, you know, you have recipient parents and you have a donor entering into this contract. They're adults. They're making an informed decision and they know what they're signing up for. The donor-conceived person is not part of this contract. They're not signing anything. They're the most affected person and they have no oversight into what's going down. They have to be prioritised as the main responsibility. The duty of care must always, always, always be to them. Yeah. Because at the end of the day, the goal of parents with using a donor, single parents, you know, whatever the case may be, and fertility clinics should not be, the goal should not be to put a baby in the arms of the parents and say, job done. The goal is to have a child who grows into a fully functioning adult,
yeah.
who is emotionally balanced and looked after and has the right to know their genetic history, has the right to know who their siblings are and how close they are. And, you know, we need to prioritize the person and not the birth.
Because the birth is, it's essentially, it's a business, isn't it?
The fertility business is, yeah, it makes a lot of money.
You track down your father. How do you manage to do that?
So you couldn't time it, you know. Mm-hmm. I didn't speak about this until I found my half-sister, maybe 8 or so years ago. And when I met her, I just realised that I wanted to honour the relationship. I had waited so long to find her.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to ever be in a situation, say I got married, you know, and I was in a room with people and they said, oh, who's that? I didn't want to be like, oh, it's my friend, because it's not. It's my half-sister. I've waited half a lifetime to find this woman. She's amazing. So I wanted to really honour that relationship. And after I found her, I was like, well, I'm just going to start telling everyone. I'm going to start telling people I'm donor-conceived.
And again, that you discover her through...
Through online DNA testing. Yeah, because
DNA.
Exactly. I had to do it myself. I had to pay for it. I had to spit in a tube and send it off and hope for the best. And I was sitting on that DNA site for years before I got a match, you know, and that's painful as well. But when I found her, I realised I wanted to honour the relationship. And I wrote an article and, you know, I just got this huge feedback from all over the world of people going, you know, looking into the mirror and not knowing who half of you was, they get, well, no one's ever said it that way. You know, I've always felt it, but I haven't seen that written down before. And I realized there was such a space where these perspectives were just not being covered as a result of a lot of the shame that kind of exists in that space. And then I wanted to do a podcast, and I started it during the pandemic when I had a bit of downtime. I'd just been made redundant. And as I was recording it, we got a match that led us to this man. So obviously it's me and my half-sister at this point. We're the only ones found. And we got a match that led us to him. And I, you know, again, after a decade and a half, suddenly in one night, you have a match that leads you to him. And within hours, I had found his website with the help of my half-sister. And I had a contact number. And I called him.
And what a rush that was to suddenly...
Yeah.
He had a website, so presumably there's a photograph...
There was a photograph. There was a video. He's a dance teacher, so there was a video of him dancing.
Were you? This is Jess, your half sister.
Jess is my half sister.
Did you discover this together? Were you sitting next to each other, or were you remote from each other?
Yeah, no, we weren't together. The DNA match popped up on my side, so I got in touch with her and told her, I think I found a match that will bring us this way. And she, you know, she started digging. I'm the journalist, but honestly, like she went deep. She found him. She found him quickly. And he just looked like both of us, you know, really? Like the title of my podcast, You Look Like Me. It's these things when you come face to face with a biological match. Mm-hmm. It's amazing what you see in yourself and mannerisms. It's not always physical, you know, it's just the way you move, the laugh. But yeah, we found him and I cold called him. And, you know, we could have we talked about, do you send an email? We could have sat there forever and back and forth about an email. And if he's going to respond to us, he'll do it, whether it's email, whether it's call. And people don't, you know. It's quicker with a phone call.
Because you're risking rejection, which can be hugely traumatic.
And also you get a rejection in real time, at least if it's a phone call, you know. Whereas if you send an email, you're just sitting there. It becomes a waiting game again, which is what I've been doing.
So you do it. You call.
I called him and I recorded the phone call because I didn't know if that was the only time I would speak to him. And Jess is, you know, live texting me, but she's never going to hear this man's voice if he says, I don't want to know you people.
Okay.
So I record the phone call and he was amazing. He welcomed us. He is very spiritual. So he was very happy to be found. And we met up with him a month later, but he was happy for me to use some of that phone call in my podcast, with his permission, of course.
Wow.
So that has been an amazing resource for people who are donor conceived, who may want to reach out, who can see that it's possible, see what the language is, see how taken aback someone who was a donor when he donated. He was never given a choice to not be anonymous.
He was going about his business that day. And
he was on a beach in Greece,
really?
You know, and he gets a phone call from someone saying, I think I'm your daughter. By the way, there's another one.
Wow. What was his reaction?
He said, you've caught me by surprise, but you were very, very welcome to have found me.
If there's a good place to be.
Yeah.
It's you a know beach what? In Greece.
Well, exactly. Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
He's obviously assuming there are people because he's donated his sperm.
Yeah, but he never thought about it. He never, ever thought about it, which is shocking now because he's so happy to be found and so open to it. But he never thought that he should sign up. You know, so he's been a great resource as well. You know, obviously my podcast is about donor conceived people, but brings in all manner of experiences. And we do have donors who speak and we do have, you know, recipient parents. My own parents are on it. And, you know,
this is Neil, by the way, biological father.
Yeah.
You've kind of got some sort of a relationship with him now.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and that's strange in itself because I didn't want another father. I had the best father. You know, I still have the best father, but he was wonderful growing up. You know, there was never a lack there. But I just, maybe it's my journalist hat. Maybe it's the desire to know where we come from. And the huge feeling of injustice that I had a right to know where I came from. So, finding him, it just answered a lot of questions that, funnily enough, had been semi-answered by finding Jess. You know, okay. Even that one biological match was important and it did answer a lot. When I found her, I did think, you know, maybe this is enough for me. But finding him has been great, yeah. And we are building to a relationship. I don't know what the relationship, how would you define it? I don't really know. But I am cautious that through this podcast and through telling this story, I am really in the minority of people who come out of these things with a happy
finding
ending.
Finding out, okay.
Finding out or finding out and being accepted.
And being accepted.
You know, people get restraining orders, as I mentioned earlier.
Wow.
People find a donor to find out they've already passed away. There are horror stories that come out of this industry. And this is why, again, I would advocate for openness, honesty, allow people to track down these biological connections as early as possible, if they choose to. Many people might not.
There must be cases as well where it becomes quite hurtful to the parent who's not the biological parent any longer, and relationships must change with all the people you've met.
Yeah, you know, it is very difficult because, again, it's different now. People go into this knowing that the donor will not be anonymous after age 18,
mm-hmm.
you know. But again, that wasn't always the case. It was, this donor will be anonymous. And I can imagine, especially for people who don't tell their children that they're donor conceived, and then they find out accidentally, and then perhaps they go on and find a biological parent. But honestly, the vast majority of us, you know, we are just not looking for a parental role. We're not looking for another parent. We just want those answers.
There's a missing piece in your life there.
There's missing information.
Right.
Yeah, for sure.
It went well for you. Does Neil, your dad, your biological father, does he know how many children have been born from his
We have absolutely
donation?
No idea. So I have found, seven half-siblings, I think.
Seven?
Yes, so far.
And have you been in contact with all of them?
No. No,
you just know that they exist out there.
Yes, there's been a recent discovery, which was three at once, which was a lot, but we have not been in contact with them. But I have spoken to people, you know, episode two of my podcast, I speak to a teenager who has 200 plus half siblings.
Wow. I presume that's in America.
That is in America.
It's highly commercialized.
Oh, it's the Wild West over there. And there's no legislation there on a kind of, you know, countrywide level.
Mm.
But you know, the numbers do get insane, and you should never, ever be put in a situation where you are creating a human being who is going to have more siblings than they have friends. I don't have 200 friends, and I certainly could not keep up with 200 half siblings.
That would be a challenge.
Yeah.
For sure. Christmas would be very traumatic.
Yeah, and expensive.
Very expensive. There is a huge, there's been a huge change, hasn't there, in terms of DNA. The DNA does not lie. And it was sitting there. I presume the clinics are quite happy when there weren't any of these genealogical sites. And I know there are ethical issues around those sites where you send a swab of your DNA off in the post to companies which have been then snapped up by pharmaceutical companies, obviously. Mm-hmm. So your family history story has become something else.
Yeah.
You're critical of the legislation around that as well, I think.
Well, I'm critical in that I say it doesn't go far enough. I do think steps are going in the right direction. Again, you know, removing anonymity for donors is excellent,
mm-hmm.
but age 18, it doesn't make sense for me. It's arbitrary. You know, it's been selected because it's like, oh, well, you're officially an adult now. But again, the pain that I sat through as a teenager with no way of getting any answers, I don't know why we're inflicting that on people. You
kind of advised your parents of donor-conceived children just to tell the story the whole way along?
That's not just my advice. It's my experience. It's coming from other donor-conceived people I've spoken to. I would say 99.9%. And yeah, but it's also the advice from people who are doing recent studies, who are looking into the emotional impact of not knowing this information and then finding out later in life, whether you're told, whether you find out. The advice is absolutely tell from day one. And that is not used to shame people who have not yet chosen, because it has been unclear previously.
Yeah.
But the advice is, if you have a donor-conceived child and they do not know, no matter what age, that conversation really does need to happen.
There's somebody in on that very thought. I welcomed my daughter in 2024, thanks to donor sperm. She will know from day one her story. We already read books on the kind man who gave the gift to our family, and I will support her decision to seek him out or not when she is older, as per the legislation, which we cover.
Yes, I love that. And this is the thing. When I advocate for this, people go, well, they're a child. You know, how will they understand that? That is a perfect example of, you know, a book has been written for this very purpose, to help a child understand. You do it in an age-appropriate way.
There's no disturbing shock that happens.
No, I mean, my sister, she grew up, she's got two mums, so she knew this was her reality the whole time. There was never any jarring moment for her. People who know from day one fare better emotionally.
The rules right now, the dramatic change came around 2020, was it? So does yes. that mean there are still people in limbo like yourself because it's not retrospective?
Exactly. Yes, yes, exactly. So, yeah, many of us are still relying on commercial DNA DNA sites. Many of us will never get information. Again, you know, you asked how many siblings I have. I have no idea. It could be, you know, my biological father donated to one clinic, or sorry, two clinics. The first four that he found were all from different clinics. We were being shared out, you know, without,
right.
yeah. So other so things. There was just no legislation. There was no legislation. Okay. Well, so again, step in
shared
and
out at a profit.
Yeah, yeah. Well, exactly. Yeah. So
I think the update to legislation is that there can be non-identifying information on their donor when people turn 16 here in Ireland. But that non-identifying, I think, is just roughly an area of the country. I mean, that doesn't give you the...
Yeah, to me, that's kind of lip service. It's fairly useless. Again, you know, you can... I think the law on kind of information that you can get about half-siblings, again, you can find out the year of birth and their gender. That's going to be half your class. You know, that doesn't help me identify who my half sibling is in any way. You know,
it might make you yearn for more.
Yeah, it's just not, it's not usable information.
The person, the donor conceived child turning 18, they still have the option to do nothing.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So what we need to start doing is putting the power in the hands of the donor conceived people. All of this, again, these are the only people who did not sign this contract, but they need the power to make these choices about, you know, do they want this information, do they not? A lot of the time they might not. If they're told from day one, might not be bothered.
Is there still a taboo around, the issue of donor-conceived children?
I think it's being broken down. And, you know, when I started my podcast, there was nothing like it. You know, like, it really did give a voice to donor-conceived people that I don't think previously existed. It was very hard to get people to come on my podcast originally. There was a trust element because I am donor conceived myself. And as the episodes moved through, that grew and it became easier for people to speak. But that people did not want to be identifiable because there was a shame. And a lot of the time, they just don't want to hurt their parents. That's what this comes back
yes,
to.
Yeah.
The shame on many levels starts there. So, you know, not to pat myself on the back, but I do think that the podcast has helped. But I do need to, you know, recognize that actually the work of other people in the fertility realm has helped a lot as well. People who are speaking out, not necessarily about like donor conception, but about their own fertility struggles. There are so many podcasts on that now. That's removing stigma. And the stigma around donation comes from the stigma around fertility. And if people at a base level who are using these services are helping to break down that stigma, you know, that's what we want. I was talking to another donor conceived person around a year ago, and they said something about someone in the playground said that they were donor conceived to them, and it was just like part of their story.
It's normal to
I was them, like, yeah. That is amazing.
That's a leaps and bounds, isn't it?
From 30 years. A different universe to what I grew up with.
And were there some concerns around this because of this, prior to this change, that maybe being the risk of being identified when the person turns 18, that might turn off people who donate sperm?
Absolutely, and it absolutely does. You know, as donor conception, you know, the 2025 budget is now expanding free IVF to people who will be using a donor.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's becoming more commonplace. We do need sperm, we do need eggs. And yes, of course, like being identifiable will turn people off. But that's just the cost that you have to pay when all the research and all the firsthand evidence is saying that donor conceived people deserve the right to know. What it has also done is some parents, some recipient parents, potential parents are still resistant to the idea of a identifiable donor. What it has done is push certain people onto the likes of Facebook groups, kind of underground sperm donation, for example. It gets dark very quickly. I could come on and talk to you for another hour about that, and we just don't have time to go that deep. But it is a very dark, murky world where men really control the narrative and the situation.
Right, it's the manosphere.
Yeah, and have you, you know, nightmares. Think of, you know, Man with 1,000 Kids, for example. It's kind of, you're going into that space. This law change and this guidance exists for a reason, and if, you know, anonymous sperm donation for the sake of your child and their health, emotionally and physically, anonymity is just not the way to go.
Right. It's keeping it open. Well, it's an interesting topic. Absolutely fascinating, Louise. Thank you so much for chatting to us. You Look Like Me is the podcast, and you hear the stories of donor-conceived kids like yourself and how they find out and what their search is like and how it's ongoing. And that's available wherever you get your podcasts, basically.
Exactly, yes.
But Louise McLaughlin, thank you so much for coming in to us, and good luck out there in the cold weather.
Thank you.
You're based in London, aren't you? So you're going back.
I am. I'm here for another few days, but yes, I'll be back to London soon.
Take care. Safe travels.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
Now, there's no more storied footballing county than the green and red of Mayo, and throughout recent years of misfortune sometimes and doubt, but always entertainment, the Mayo people's spirit for their team has remained undiminished. And this morning we're joined by one of the legendary figures from that generation of players who've endured an extraordinary and enthralling, I think it's 6 All-Ireland finals, 7 if you're counting replays. He's only just retired from the inter-county altar and he's a bit of a giant, Rob Henley. How are you doing? Good morning.
Yeah, good. Thanks for having me, Oliver. It's good to be here.
You were Mayo's second choice and then first choice goalkeeper in your career, isn't that right? And
yeah.
3 All-Ireland finals you started in.
Yeah.
Not many people in the goalies jerseys get to do that in their career.
No, it's only kind of in the last couple of weeks I've been really reflecting on it. You know, as a young keeper starting out, what I've thought I got to play in 3 All-Irelands, be part of 6 or 7 of them. I probably wouldn't have thought that, so you know, I'm very lucky from that perspective, but obviously we didn't get the result in the end that we wanted, but to be up at that level consistently over 10, 15 year period, you know, I think it was a testament to the team and the players that we had, and I suppose the resilience that we kind of showed that we could keep coming back, especially when we were playing as some of the teams that we got to play against over that period as well. But yeah, it's kind of weird. I wouldn't really have reflected on too much in my career, but it's kind of in the last 2-3 weeks you kind of try and digest, I suppose, make the most of the situation. You're kind of like, well, what can I pull from it that's positive? But I suppose when I reflect on that, that's probably the most positive, that I got to play at the highest level for as long as I did.
It sounds like it's only dawning on you now.
That is, you don't want to, because I suppose my mindset up until very recently was that, you know, this year and getting an opportunity to go that step further and try and push it on for as long as I could. But once you kind of make the decision to step away from that, you kind of have to then look and just take stock of it and see what you can take learnings from it. And I suppose that's what I've been doing. And, you know, thankfully I have some nice memories to look back on, and, you know, great friendships and so many positives.
Yeah, yes, you do. What age are you?
I'm 34.
Is that considered old now in this semi-professional age of GAA athleticisms?
I don't know. I think, well, there's been a few. Obviously, Michael Murphy's come out of retirement, and you see Conor McManus and Manon is staying on. And, you know, it's great to see. I think it's something that we need to look to do more of, is keep older players in the game. I think for me, like as a keeper, it's like it wasn't a physical, like I physically felt like I could keep playing and mentally and all that, but it was just more the toll it was taking on other aspects of my life. And I'm living in Dublin, you know, I've been travelling up and down to Dublin for 10, 15 years now to get to training and stuff. So
The whole time,
like I love living in Dublin, so it was something I was more than willing to do, but at some point it kind of starts to take a toll. And then obviously we've a child coming in the end of March, so that was going to put a stifler on it anyways. So it's better to make the decision now, I suppose, in a couple of months' time.
You told everyone just before Christmas?
Yeah, so really quick. In the end, it was very quick. I kind of sprung it on everyone close to me. I just had one car journey. I'd been thinking about it for a long time, but it was one car journey. It just became very clear to me that it wasn't sustainable. And I just made a couple of calls, and it was done, basically, from my perspective at that point. And I trained one more time at Mayo, and that was it. That was my last session.
You must know exactly how long it takes to drive from wherever you are in Dublin to training every week. How long did it take?
Well, it's kind of averaged out about 2.5 hours, but it depends what time you leave. If you leave at 6 a.m, it's 2.5 hours. If you leave at the wrong time, it can be 3.5-4 hours. Like, you know, the traffic
back
in Dublin.
All those years.
Yeah, but I actually, you know, I like driving, so I didn't look it on as a kind of a task. It was just something. It was nice time by yourself. You could listen to podcasts, do different things like that, make the most of the time. But like when you look at the cumulative effect of it, does have an impact on everything, the body, and it's a lot. It's, you know, 15, 20 hours a week in a car, you know.
Would you have come from training and driven back?
Yeah, I'd usually go up and down the one day. So like that was, and yeah, I wasn't the only one doing it. I'm sure there's plenty of lads all over the country doing it.
Yes,
but I know that road well, and you know, that's the other thing as well. It's you know, getting on the road every day, is there's risk in that as well, you know. And but it was worth it. It was worth it, definitely.
You've a lot going on in your life, as you say. You're married. That's the lovely Orla.
Yes.
She's expecting in March. Work, where do you work?
I'm working in a company just 10, 15 minutes from here, Cartrawler. It's an Irish tech company. So, you know, I'm very lucky, you know, throughout my footballing career, I was able to, you know, progress my professional career, which is what actually pays the bills.
Doesn't always happen.
No. And, you know, I kind of made a conscious effort that I didn't want to, you know, let's say sacrifice parts of my career to just to play football. And as such, you know, I obviously lived in Dublin and I was lucky enough to get a great role in Cartrawler. It's a great Irish company, tech company, very proud of it.
It operates around the world as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, so we work with
What does it do?
So car rental, very exciting, car rental technology. So if you're ever booking a flight and you get offered, do you want to book a car rental? There's a good chance Cartrawler do that technology.
See.
Now we do it across. So we work with like American Airlines, EasyJet, Jet2 over in the UK. We also work with like the Uber and Hopper and stuff like that. So really, really cool company, great culture, you know, and it's great for me that, you know, it's totally separate to my football, but it's just as challenging in different ways. So I'm very lucky.
You have a club now in Dublin. You have for the last few years, haven't you?
Yeah. So I joined, started 2023 to try and kind of limit the amount of time I spent in the car. I said it wasn't going to be sustainable at the split season to do, you know, for 9-10 months a year, be up and down to Dublin. And I just made a decision. I was like, okay, well, if I'm going to do it now, I might as well join the club while I'm still half decent at football. And so at the start of January 2023, I reached out to Rini and asked them if they'd like another keeper. Yeah. And thankfully, they were great, really open to me coming in. It's been a breath of fresh air, to be honest. I'm really excited about kind of committing more time to them over the next few months because it's only 15 minutes over the road for me now.
It's a huge club.
Yeah, big club. Yeah, big club, lovely area. Like a non-area I would have been awfully familiar with before I joined. But like everyone I've met there have been incredible. And it's kind of nice playing club football in Dublin because every time you go to a game, you meet someone from Mayo because there's so many Mayo people up here and they all come up to you afterwards. And
there's nobody in Mayo.
No, in fairness, that's unfortunately a lot of people have left. But so yeah, it's been a great experience.
So you finish up your career, your inter-county career, that is, because you're still playing away in the club. 7 Connacht Championship medals, 2 league titles, 2 All-Star nominations along the way, probably the hardest All-Star to win, and lots more medals under 21 level and college level because you went to DCU here in Dublin. A lot of pain along the way. Was it worth it?
Yeah, it was. It was worth it, definitely. Because like for the pain, yeah, there was individually and collectively we'd pain in the losses, but it was worth it because, you know, we were literally pushing ourselves as hard as we could for as long as we could. And I could say that for every teammate I had throughout that whole period, whether they were in the squad for 1 year or for 12 years or 15 years. And you don't get that in too many, you know, walks of life where you're in a group with everyone pushing in the same direction, trying to be the best you can be. And, you know, we got so close. And as I said, we played, come up against, you know, a generational team in Dublin, but also, you know, a really, really strong Donegal team, probably an underrated Donegal team in 2012. And of course,
that was the first of the kind of All-Irelands, wasn't it?
That was the first one in 2012. Yeah. So
you started the following year in that All-Ireland final.
In 2013 was the first time we played Dublin in All-Ireland final. And yeah, mad game as well. A lot of them were mad games.
They were never boring.
No. This is me looking at it from my perspective, but I felt like with Dublin, we always kind of prepared to go toe-to-toe with them, which often was to our detriment, but it also put them in a position where they made mistakes that they wouldn't usually make. So it was kind of a challenging game for them. Ultimately, though, if you look at the averages, they won out most of them. So they were obviously able to finish games out and they had that couple of percent that we didn't have. But
what was maddening for the neutrals of us watching always was Dublin was just hammering everyone around them. And then they meet Mayo, the only team that could, as you say, go toe-to-toe. But, you know, 1-point victories eked out. They just managed to get past.
Yeah, well, they had like such strong squads. Like you'd have one player marked and then some fellow come off the bench. And, you know, I don't know how many times that happened to us and he'd, you know, kick 3 or 4. But like, you know, when I look at my career and I was reflecting on it, one of the things I'm so proud of or was very lucky to have was that I played with some of the best players probably to ever play the game. You know, Leakey and Keating, it's not going to mention them all, but incredible players, but also got to play against some incredible players. When you look at over the years, that Dublin team, like some Michael Murphy, you know, different counties across the country, even keeper-wise, it was a golden generation for goalkeepers as well. Like David Clark in my own team, obviously Stephen Cluxton in his pomp, but even the likes of Niall Morgan, Roy Began, you know, you see Sean Patton, Shane Ryan.
It was a period that changed goalkeeping.
Yeah, it was.
It's much harder.
And it's changing again, I think, as well, which is exciting too. So, yeah, loads of positives. But it was probably hard to watch from the neutral perspective. But, you know, we gave it everything and, you know, we tried things. And, you know, at the end of the day, Dublin just had that bit on us.
Does it matter that you didn't win in All-Ireland along those years?
Yeah, it mattered to me. I felt like we worked hard enough to get one, probably not maybe smart enough all the time, unfortunately. And, you know, when you look back, you want to have that All-Ireland.
I suppose what I mean is, you know, the memories are so incredible. Yeah. And each time playing this sport at the top level with a million people watching All-Ireland finals every time, I mean, that has to mean something as well.
Oh, it does. It does. And as I said, when I reflect on it, you know, it's unique. Like, it is unique when I was chatting to someone from Australia this morning. She knows a bit about football and she was, you know, she thinks it's mad that there's these two kind of career of running side by side, one where you're playing in front of Croke Park and then the next day you're in the office.
Your job, yeah.
And she was just saying that, and she doesn't really know much about Gaelic football. But, you know, at the end of the day, from a player's perspective, it's about that extra percent, because if we can get over the line in those on that big day, I would love to have experienced what would happen, you know, after that and things like that. So, yeah, regrets around that. But, of course, I'm so grateful. Like, 95% of players who go out in their career don't get to play for their county. They don't get to play and win provincial championships. They definitely don't get to play in All-Ireland finals if they're not doing that.
Yeah.
So, you know, extremely grateful that, you know, I got to experience all of that and the good parts of it and the bad parts of it.
And as a result, Mayo remain contenders, because obviously it encourages other youngsters to come up, doesn't it?
And like, I, you know, when I started kind of properly playing championship football in 2011, like prior to that, like, you know, Mayo football wasn't in a great place. You know, I think the last 10, 15 years has given us a great foundation.
You forget that actually, wouldn't you? 2011, you were what, 20 years of age?
21 is my first championship, but I'd been in the squad the 2 years previous. But, you know, we'd been beaten by Longford and Sligo the year previous in 2010. It was a really bad year for Mayo football. You know, we were going into the kind of final. I think every game that year we were underdogs. You know, to get from that position to being in a position where we're All-Ireland contenders consistently every year. And I think what we're seeing now is a new generation of players come through, which is really exciting. But also seeing some of the lads that I played with are getting involved with underage teams in Mayo and senior teams across the country. And that's exciting as well, to see them coming through and coaching and what that'll bring to the overall system in Mayo. I think it's going to be really positive as well.
Yeah, you mentioned 2011 you started. Was your family steeped in GAA? Were you coming from a long line of...
I wouldn't say we're steeped. Like, they're all as into GAA, like on both sides of the family. But like, there wasn't, you know, Mayo footballers, you know, at senior level in the family, really. So it wasn't necessarily that. I was probably, in my own immediate family, I was the only one who really got into it, to be honest.
What's the main interest of the family?
Just generally across sport generally, in fairness. We would play a bit of golf when I was younger, and, you know, obviously GAA was in Mayo. Like, we're a bit spoiled because GAA is the only sport, really. Like, soccer, I played soccer and all that, but like, GAA is
not much competitive
sport.
Yeah,
it's not, compared to other counties, and it's an advantage we have as well. And, you know, that, you know, if you're younger, if you're a good soccer player, unless you're going to potentially go to England, if you're a good soccer player or a good Gaelic player, you're more likely going to go and play Gaelic, because there's the opportunities lie there in Mayo. So
it's funny how that goes, isn't it, culturally? Because there was years in Limerick they thought, oh, we'd have a great hurling team if only some people would give up a bit of rugby. And of course it veers in that direction.
It does, and it's like a virtuous circle then, because they're doing better, more people want to play hurling. And, you know, you see it in Dublin with football now. The numbers they have in football is incredible, you know. So,
including yourself, of course, there. But the family, I think, were involved in horses, are they?
Yeah, Dad, in fairness to him, we've a farm at home, and Dad, you know, breeds horses and stuff like that. So he's been into it for a long, long time, and still has a couple of horses running with Gavin Cromwell and stuff. So it's like massive passion, like, for the whole family. We love horse racing. It's great, great sport, and love horses as animals as well, so they're like extended family.
An all-encompassing sport, isn't it? You rarely have such a GAA you know, greats emerging out of horsey families.
No, well, and we're not. I wouldn't necessarily describe it as a horsey family, but because, you know, Mayo wouldn't be the typical thoroughbred racing part of the world. But in fairness to Dad, he just always had an interest in them, and now he's, you know, he does it all himself at home on the farm, and it's something that we're always going to be interested in.
You had to fight for your position as the goalie, and that was, I presume, driving up and down for Dublin was part of kind of a show of determination.
Yeah, like I think I said this in the last couple of weeks, but, you know, one thing that I was very lucky to get was that my whole career basically was in parallel with David Clark, who was the other keeper at Mayo, and like an incredible keeper, Mayo's best keeper ever. And, you know, someone that, you know, I have huge admiration for, but of course we were both going for the same position, and yeah, it's not like you can, you know, use a keeper for 10 or 15 minutes at the end of the game. It's a very black and white position. You're either starting or you're
it
not.
Is, yeah.
And it was great. I think, I don't know, sometimes I think would both of us prefer it if neither of us had to compete with each other and we just had it for that 10 or 12 years. But look, the matter of the fact is that we were competing against each other, and I do think, you know, in the particularly the last 6-7 years, it made me a much better keeper. And I think, you know, Clark and I often would talk about this, that, you know, we both were probably better as a result of it. You know, he's a hugely competitive person, so he had great quality of training. And it meant, you know, over the course of that period that it was going over and back between us. I started in 2011, he was 2012. He got injured in 13, I came in. You know, it was this kind of...
You're sitting around waiting for the goalie to get injured, basically, so that they're at their out of position. And there's only one position if you're a goalie, so
only one
set
position.
Your sights on that.
Yeah, and it's like a game within a game. It's similar to Rick Brogby, the out-half position. It's, you know, you kind of have to have a different skill set. You train together. It's very, you know, it's a strange one. We room together for all the time we go in away games. So you're very close, but
the
at the same time, you're competing against each other. But it was great. As I said, like to play, I think, 75 times for Mayo in a time where David Clark was also there. I think it was a big achievement. And, you know, I got to play against in some of the biggest games in that time as well.
You did, for sure. There's a message here saying Rob Save versus David Clifford in the league final 2019 was the winning of the league, world-class save. Even Clifford couldn't believe how he saved it. Thanks, Rob, for all your years of service to the green and red. That's from Paul in County Mayo.
Oh, it's very nice. Yeah.
When people come up to you, do they point to specific memories? Are they always positive?
When they come up to me, yeah, they usually point to, in fairness to them, yeah, they would usually point to different times, like 2021 when we bet Dublin in the semi-final or that, the league final. Most people who come up, you know, usually it's kind of to chat about, generally about Mayo football and, like, wish we could get over the line or could have got over the line, all those things. And we're kind of in it together because that's how we all feel. It was very much a collective in Mayo in relation to, we're all on the same journey together, so it's kind of like they know you because we've been playing, you know, Mayo supporters. It's like a big kind of collective, as I said. So the conversations vary. Like, you know, obviously you get the negative ones around, you know, this shouldn't have happened and things like that. But
what do you say to people, partner? Come on, you know, having driven up and down 5-hour, 6-hour round trips training, then someone points out a flaw that happened along.
Yeah. Oh, well, it's part, I'm not saying I always reacted well to it, but when I look at it, you know, people care. They care so much about it. Like, you know, Mayo supporters in particular care so much about it that, you know, they're entitled to have an opinion. They drive up and down to matches in Dublin and they go to games in the league and all this stuff. So, you know, it's one thing I can't begrudge a supporter is having an opinion on it because, you know, they're entitled to it. They love Mayo football. I would say to them, yeah, of course, you know, we do too, and we're doing all this work to try and not make those mistakes. But I suppose I'd admire someone who would actually say it to my face as well. You know, you can have a conversation with them, and usually, you know, it kind of it peters out then, and they kind of see your perspective on it. But you know, I have to understand, like, they're entitled to their opinion, and sometimes their opinions are correct as well, so you have to take that on board too.
I want to bring you back to somewhere you probably don't want to go. First of all, there was an unbelievable crazy final in 2016, the original final, and it comes to replay. There's two goals in that, isn't there? And one of them's an own goal.
Two of them.
Very early on in the match.
Two of them were own goals.
David Clark, two of them were own goals. That's just extraordinary. I can't even believe it. Now, more than 8 years later, David Clark is in goals. But incredibly, Mayo draw that game and force it to a replay. And then that's followed by one of the, I think, objectively madcap management decisions in All-Ireland history, which was to switch the goalkeeper just days before the replay. And that switch was to you.
Yeah. It was mad. It was a mad period. Like, the first game was, you know, the idea of, I don't think I've ever seen an own goal in a GA match or too many of them, and to have two goals conceded, and obviously, you know, we pulled it back, then Killian kicked an unbelievable point to level it later on, and, you know, it was a good performance first day. But I suppose we had 2 week period in between that game, and, you know, I did think after the first game there was a chance I could play. But, you know, at the same time, it was a small chance. It was just because I think Dublin had a big press on our kickouts in the first game, and we'd struggled a bit to win them. So I thought maybe there's a chance. But anyways, a couple of days before it, get get the call like on the Thursday that I was going to be playing on the Saturday, and, you know, don't say it to anyone, the usual stuff. And I took that to heart. Didn't say it to anyone, didn't say it to Orla, didn't say it to my family, whatever, which in fairness, like, you know, they wanted to keep
Difficult preparation.
I was, yeah, because I wasn't mentally ready for playing. Like, it's totally different. Let's say if Clarke got injured at training Wednesday, you know, it's different mindset.
Yeah.
But when I'm replacing Dave Clarke, who is incredible keeper, did very little wrong in the previous game, I could understand why they would do it.
In fact, a lot of his saves is the reason it goes to a replay, isn't it?
Oh, he made two or three like one-on-one saves, you know, and obviously massive experience. And while us as a team could understand the call, and you know, if you step back, you could understand why you would maybe put me in for the kickouts. It was still a massive call to make, and you know, for me, I just wasn't ready for it. And as much as I tried to wrap my head around it, in the days previous, you know, a 2-day turnaround to get your head right for an All Ireland final replay,
it's impossible.
It was a bit difficult. But
and you're what, 25, 26?
Yeah, 26, and like I had good experience. Like as I said, it's you know, when I think about it now, I'm sure there's people out there listening, that's the best thing. You'd love that opportunity to play an All Ireland, and I did, and I was trying to battle with this.
But it was also the big talking point in the run up to it. So you were suddenly the centre of national sporting attention.
Yeah.
And of course, what are we, 10, 5 minutes into the second half? You make a mistake that really...
Kind of, yeah. It was, yeah. I just took my off it. But it was kind of, when I look at that mistake, it was coming, you know, when I look back at my performance now, kind of objectively. And, you know, in the first half, I think I made a mistake. Didn't hit a kick out to Shane O'Shea, and Leroy ended up getting, Lee Keegan ended up getting black carded. And I remember thinking, oh my God, like that was probably the bigger moment, because Lee was our best player, having to go off at the time.
So you're shook from that?
I'm shook from that.
You're blaming yourself there.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, I was in a constant state of anxiety from the moment I got the call telling him I was starting till like the night before night before the All Ireland final. You know, you think you're not going to be able to sleep. I was in bed at 9 and I slept till 9 o'clock the next morning because I was just exhausted.
You're wrecked.
I was just exhausted. So, yeah, I just didn't have the skills to deal with that type of situation. Mm. And like, you know, now looking back, I probably have them now because I learned from it the hard way. But, you know, there was lots of things that could have been done to avoid it.
Which part do you think was a mistake? Because you come running out, don't you? There's a kick pass from about the 45.
Yeah.
You're coming around and you fumble the ball.
Yeah, yeah.
And you obviously notice they're through on goal. So you've got a drag.
Yeah, well... So that's
Paddy Andrews,
a mistake,
isn't it?
Yeah, and
drag him down, and you get black carded.
That's the thing with you know, big games, and if you don't have the mindset or you haven't done the prep, the simple things become very hard to do. And that was a simple catch, and you know, I've obviously learned from it since. But you know, at that time, you take your eye off it because you're trying to think 2-3 steps ahead, and you make the mistake. You know, I think it was a soft enough when I look at it objectively. You know, I got Conte on the ball. I think it was soft enough penalty. But you know, once you're scrambling like
you
that,
the ref is,
I need to hit the. I know, so not getting into that part. But
anyway, you had to sit on the sidelines watching Dermot Connolly score the penalty.
Yeah.
Have you ever watched the moment back?
Oh, I have. Yeah, of course. Yeah, I've like reviewed it all because I had to learn from it. So reviewed it all. Watched like on the sideline, you're just kind of going through, you're just hoping the team can pull out of the bag so that you can get the mistake isn't what cost the game. That's your kind of mindset in the sideline. So obviously we didn't get over the line, and
only by a point.
Yeah, and we, you know, we put a massive effort in even to get it to a point, like, and yeah, it was just, yeah, it was not
people
a good
remember
day.
The team came straight around you, didn't they, at the final whistle to show their support. In other words, you know, we're all in it together.
Yeah,
one mistake isn't the reason we've lost the match.
Yeah, like, you know, when I think about it, that time, you know, after the media aftermath, the biggest thing for me was, like, obviously my family were incredible, because your circle gets really small once something like that happens. And family are incredible, but my teammates were unbelievably supportive, like way more than I thought they would be. I thought, you know, they'd hate me because of the performance. But every single one of them, to a man, like even including Clarke, it was obviously not an easy day for him because... You know, he was getting dropped and all of that stuff. And, you know, it, from that perspective, you know, that gave me a great heart that at least I still had the respect of my teammates, and I could kind of build from there, try and rebuild from there more so than build from there. And, you know, from my perspective, you know, that was something that I really appreciated. I had a great support at home. I had my family. I could, you know, that place where I could go and be safe, you know, after that game.
And
then I had my teammates.
Because people became very stupid about that, didn't they? There was a lot of abuse.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, like, there is going to be, like, this is something I know now, but at the time it was a bit, it was, you know, obviously it felt very personal and all that. But, yeah, there was.
It was personal.
Yeah. And, you know, this is the nature of sport, and we see it every day of the week in professional sport. You know, you are going to become, you know, part of the public discourse, and you're going to get abuse online and letters to the house and all this crack. Like, so it was difficult to take at that time because I was thinking the same thing as a lot of the people were saying, you know. So was just, you know, a bad kind of place to be in for a relatively young lad who had other things in his life that he should have been able to focus on.
You were definitely
well.
A young lad.
Yeah, you well, yeah.
And this is the moment where people forget that sport is entertainment, you know, and that doesn't mean if a mistake is made that anyone has died.
Yeah.
But it's treated so seriously, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, back to my point earlier, it means so much to so many people. And, you know, when you have a game like that where such a big decision's made and it doesn't work out, you know, people are entitled to ask questions, you know, why this happened. And unfortunately, there was probably a bit of a void after this where no one really spoke. And I think that was, you know, that was meant anyone could give an opinion and that would fill the void. And, you know, when I look back, that probably wasn't handled that well. We could have probably, as a, you know, Mayo generally could have probably put out a statement or said something a bit better after it. But look, that's...
Because the abuse was so severe, wasn't it, as well? But the wonderful thing about the story is that there's a very good redemption in 2021 where you have another heart-stopping moment. But we're going to take a quick break before we come to that. Now I'm here with Rob Henley, who's freshly retired from the Mayo Intercounty team. And we were talking about the bad moments of 2016, Rob. But 2021 is the redemption moment, isn't it? Remind us what's happening. Dublin are the absolute pinnacle. They're going for 7 All-Irelands in a row. They're literally unstoppable at this stage. And what is there, 2 minutes left in the match and they're a point ahead?
Oh, yeah. I think it's like, it was a bit of controversy because I got to take it twice, but I think it's on the stroke or close enough to the stroke as the last minute of extra time. And, you know, it's what everyone dreams of as a young lad, an opportunity.
It's a 45.
To leveler from a 45.
You've already taken it and didn't go.
There was a sub, something coming on, and the linesman was saying to me, hold, hold, hold. And I just kicked it anyways to get a bit of nervousness out of the legs. But, so then I got a chance to take it again, obviously, and just, you know, as I said, just stuck to the process.
To level the game and bring it to extra time.
Yeah.
And can the goalie, the wounded goalie, heal the scars of 2016? Here's Darren Maloney.
So the 7 minutes have gone, the referee will add probably another two. So Hennelly missed the first one, he loves this one, and Hennelly has put it between the posts. He had to wait such a long time. Nerves of steel, ice in the veins from Rob Hennelly.
That was a special moment for Mayo because obviously extra time you go on and finally beat the Dubs.
Mm. Yeah, I know, it was great. And like, even to hear Dara's commentary there describing ice in the veins, like, you know, previous years it wouldn't ever have been described as that. So for me, from a performance perspective, to be able to get to a place where I could, you know, actually deliver under the pressure like that, it was very satisfying, more so than the result or anything. So... and look, we didn't go on inevitably and win All Ireland, but it was.
Inevitably, yeah.
Inevitably.
Incredibly,
now.
Yeah. Incredibly, yeah. When you look at it, that, you know, you're the first team to beat the Dubs going for the 7 in a row, and it's Tyrone then that.
Yeah. And look, that was another learning I had to go through again, but, you know, it was still a long way back. And, you know, when I came out of 2016, I genuinely didn't think I'd play for Mayo again. You know, that was, you know, my objective was very basic. I just wanted to play for Mayo again, like at any, you know, a league game. Yeah. And, you know, 2017, I didn't play a minute. So, you know, to be, my two objectives were to play for Mayo again and then to be, if possible, taken seriously as a goalkeeper again. And, you know, I think by the end of my career, I think I'd definitely done both of those. And of course, you know, 2016 still happened, but at least it wasn't the end point for me.
No, just very important. And a lot of people agree because lots of messages coming in. What a gorgeous guy. That's from a Dublin GA fan. Love the way they have to qualify it. Rob is a gentleman, had a superb career with Mayo. He left the jersey in a better place. And that's from Colin Brennan. Rob was so good to my sick son who loved GA. What a man. That's from Kyle and family from the Rossies. And congrats on a fantastic career. Thanks for the great memories. A legend and a real gentleman. That's from your Uncle Peter.
No, it's a biased audience you picked there.
And yeah. Somebody is doing the whole Mayo thing where they said, it was pointed out in a Mayo newspaper, Mayo first won in Ireland in 1936, which is a square number, 44 by 44. The next highest square number is 2025, 45 by 45. So this could be our year. It better be, because the next square number is 2116.
Okay.
That'd be a bit of a wait.
Definitely be around for that one.
How do you look back on it? Are you delighted? Are you kind of... it was good to be there, wasn't it?
And yeah.
Proud moments.
Absolutely. Like, I'm very grateful because, like, my career, I thought I wouldn't have any, you know, even to retire on my own terms, I didn't think I'd have that luxury, which lots of players don't get to do, you know, to get brought in or to get dropped or for whatever reason or get injured, even worse. You know, so I got to do that. And when I look back, the players I got to play with, the experiences that we got to have together, the teams we got to play against. And, you know, I was part of that, whether I was on the field or as a sub. And, you know, when I look at my career, I experienced every part of being a footballer, basically bar one, which is the final one, which was Windhoek Ireland. But like, it's a pretty, you know, full picture to have in a career looking back on it. And, you know, if I was to go back and look at myself at the start and look ahead, and you know, I probably would have taken it, you know, at the time. So I'm very grateful. I've learned so much. You know, I'm hoping that I can, you know, still play for another few years with Raheny and yeah. you know, hopefully drive on, do something good with them. But, you know, help, you know, the big thing I would say I've had over the last couple of years is people reach out to me who've been in similar situations, you know, and help as much as I can other players. And
management,
other
players. Maybe?
Management, yeah. I'd love to go into management at some point in the future,
great.
Yeah, but not anytime soon. But yeah.
Other things to do in the meantime.
But listen,
Rob, thanks so much for entertaining us over the years and best luck to you and Orla becoming parents at the end of March. 2025 is a big year. This is where life is only starting.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Oliver.
Good luck to you. Now, a very quick break. Thanks to Fergus out there. Diabetes.ie is the place to get all your information from. Now, beloved Irish actor and gem of Westmeath, Mary McAvoy, joins me this morning. She can add calendar curl to her list of achievements.
I forgot to bring it in. Somebody bring it in.
Oh, for goodness sake, I was looking forward to seeing that.
Yeah.
And you're Miss October, Mary McAvoy.
Yes.
Which is out now. Good morning. What is the calendar about?
The calendar is from a gym called Body Empowerment in Adamstown, Delvin. It's literally a gym in a field. And a group of us got together to do a calendar to raise money for the Irish Cancer Society. And I miss October. And you can, you know, and it's, I know it's, we're into the new year, but it's only, you know, it's only a little bit.
Yeah,
into
I
the
don't
new
have
year.
A calendar yet, actually.
Oh, well, you can put that one up.
Plenty
there.
Of us are.
Yeah,
sort
it's
of,
completely yeah. inappropriate, but anyway, sure.
Is it inappropriate?
No, it's not really inappropriate, but you know. It's very hard to discuss because nowadays we have to be very careful about sexism and everything else, so you have to be very careful.
Well, it's nude-ish women.
Not really, no. There's one bowled one there in the nude and then the rest of us are relatively covered.
Yeah, no, that's people are very well covered
yes,
up here.
Yeah.
Now,
but everybody's...
I have to go to October. Do I have to find you?
No, I'm there. You see, I'm down in the corner there. You don't have to open it. No, see it there?
Oh,
the
yes,
purple
you're
scarf.
Lifting a weight and you've got a big purple thing right across. You're kind of like a Roman empress.
Of course. I mean, why not?
That's the look you're rocking.
Yeah,
there.
And I miss October because I turned 70 in October. So that's what I got the thing. Saying, you know, so Frank and I had great chats outside about what it's like to be in the 70s.
Septuagenarian.
Septuagenarian.
But did you probably think about it the whole year running up to it?
No, I'm treating the year after my birthday as like the Queen's Jubilee or the Silver Jubilee. So it's an entire year. An entire year of celebrations, darling. Yes, we're going to do lots and lots and lots of things over the year. No, but it is scary. And I mean, you were talking there about the age and getting old and all that kind of thing. And when you do say those words, I am 70 years of age, it can be really kind of daunting. You have to kind of just kind of pull yourself back and say, keep going to the gym, keep, you know, don't,
yeah.
because...
That's a kind of a good warning in your head, is it?
It is, but it's kind of, it's you have to fight the ageism in your own head as well. Do you know what
true.
I mean?
It's true.
Because you can, you know, like I want to start running again and I'm kind of going, but you're 70, Mary, you can't be running. And of course, why not? Do you know,
reason.
I mean, I might run very slowly, but I always ran very slowly. So, but it's just, it's a kind of a thing, you know, and then you kind of think, you know, oh, I must do that now. That'd be lovely to do that one day. And I'm kind of going, Mary, you're 70. You better do it quick. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Because you're kind of shutting yourself down all the time.
Yeah, like
it's going to,
you know,
everything's
you always think you have that luxury of time. Do you know? But having said that, like there's people, you know, dying in accidents and whatever. So you, like, life is so unpredictable. So you know, I could have another 40 years in me, and somebody else, you know, who's a lot younger might have 40 days. Do you know, you don't know. You have to just keep in the moment, I suppose, and try and still that voice of ageism in your own head. You know
just
what I mean?
A negative voice that taps away there.
Oh yeah. You
have I have tell it at 40 the odd time as well, and then you go, what am I talking about?
What?
Yeah, I'll get that little voice, you know, because you're not 20 anymore.
Oh, yeah, but like, so when you're 20, really would you want to be 20 again?
No, absolutely.
No. You didn't have a tit.
You spend your
30s
kind of mourning your 20s. Yeah. And then you get over that and you spend your 40s mourning your 30s. Is that how it goes?
I didn't mourn anything. In fact, I quite like being old. I quite like it. I like it.
Good.
It's like, as you say, Roman empress. I feel I've entered my what do they call us now? Queenagers. I'm a queenager.
And Pat Kinnavan says he enjoys seeing the wrinkles form in the mirror.
Oh, I love the mirror, the wrinkles.
Actors, I think you get a different.
I think wrinkles are beautiful. I'm sorry, I do. I worked with Siobhan McKenna years ago, and of course half the audience won't know who Siobhan McKenna is, but she was the uncrowned queen of Ireland. She was a great international actress and very famous. And I worked with her just towards the end of her life. And I remember watching her in her mirror, like making herself up in her mirror. And she was in her early 60s, you know, and she had this beautiful face. I mean, it had all the wrinkles, it had everything. Yeah. And she just looked stunning and far more beautiful to me at that age. And I was in my 30s at that time than she was when she was younger. She was beautiful. And I feel that. I feel that wrinkles add something, and there's something uncompromising. We have to change the way we think about age.
But actually, I was reading the New York Times over Christmas, and apparently one of the trends for 2025 are de-Botoxing in order to get the wrinkles and the natural look back in the face.
So everybody go around looking like burst balloons now. If they take all the Botox out, they'll be all flopping around the place.
Can't be reversed for a lot of people.
No.
Come here, do you recommend the gym?
Oh, hugely. Like, I mean, this seems to be a theme. We didn't decide on a theme, but there just seems to be a theme.
Stefan Fergus.
I can't recommend working out with weights and stuff highly enough, again, for people of age, but for anybody. But I'll just say just a little interesting story for me. 3 years ago, I have a problem with my left knee. I got an MRI and there was more pages in it than War and Peace. So I don't even know. There was meniscus tears and lateral this and bleh. Anyway, so, you know, it wasn't looking good. And I couldn't really go upstairs and I couldn't really go downstairs without limping. And I remember once my knee gave out outside Trinity College. You see, that was it. You see, it's like the Protestant set it out in for me. Now I've just said something. Don't get
casual
all
sectarianism.
Don't get all upset about that. That's just a joke from my era. Some of my best friends are Protestants.
See, I love it. That's another reason to grow old, because you can say whatever you want.
Well, we'll see. But anyway, I literally couldn't walk. I was going down to bazaars and I literally couldn't walk. And anyway,
there are loads of people, by the way, like this, who just ignore that twiggling pain and go, oh, it's just my age.
This wasn't twiggling pain. This was like serious. Leg will not bend. Anyway, one word. Anyway, so there was all sorts of things. Go to physiotherapy. I went to that gym. I was told, don't do lunges, don't do squats, don't. It's not in the gym now. Don't do this, don't do that. And I knew that my body wanted to do that. I just knew it wanted to do that. Here I am, 2 years later, after working out in the gym regularly, and my knee is perfect. Gives a little twinge, but I'm not limping.
Really?
I can run, I can walk, I can do everything. Perfect.
All from your gymming, which was obviously
set up program.
People
tend to think that you know, you have to fix the joint, but you can actually fix the muscles around the joint as well. If you strengthen the muscles around the joint that's wonky, you're giving yourself strength. Now, it's not going to work for everybody. If you have a really damaged knee, you're probably looking at something like cortisone or whatever, or a replacement. Yeah. But there are so many things you can do. And particularly for older people, again, I think gym and fitness should be key. Really key.
And they're in rural areas now everywhere.
Yes, everybody. Like literally our gym is in a field, you know, in a racing track.
It's in a shed in a field.
Yeah, but it's like... But
it's open air.
Yeah, but it's not now like a rusty old shed. It's a very nice, beautiful insulation shed.
How is life in rural Ireland these days for you?
I love it.
Are you still living in the house you grew up in?
I am, yeah.
So you
never
were
left.
In Dublin for a couple of years, were you, when you were...
When I was in Glenroe and as a professional actress, I like the tress. I like actress. I like being a woman. I don't like being neutralised.
Not an actor.
No, I'm not. I'm a woman.
She's an actress.
I'm an actress.
Very good. Anyway, sorry for,
don't
sorry
like
for
the no, it's not your fault. Everybody does it. But what was I going to say? What were we talking about?
We're talking about you living in Rhode Island because you're back living where you grew up.
Yeah, no, so I never really left. I was the typical country person that went home at the weekends.
And you're an
only
child.
The mammy and the daddy. And I'm an only child. And my mum and dad were a bit older when I was born. So I always felt a sense of responsibility. So I didn't do the thing of going to London to see if I'd get acting work there or anything. So I stayed at home to look after them.
Do you think about that?
No. No.
No regrets?
No regrets. No, why? What's the point? I go out and hug a sheep and you have no regrets when you hug a sheep. That's the thing.
And your parents were sheep farmers?
They were farmers in general. Like back in the 50s, it was everything. It was crops. I saw threshers and all of these things. And like, it sounds like, you know, in another world. We had huge big dray horses like Clydesdales.
Yeah, yeah.
We had all of that. And all of those things. And, we didn't have balers for hay. We made cocks of hay and all that kind of thing. That changed so much. Life changed so
You've
much.
You've seen so many changes.
Yeah,
that generation
hugely,
born in the
hugely.
50s.
Yeah.
And what about now?
What do I mean? Well, I have...
In terms of rural Ireland now, like, I mean, is it...
I love rural Ireland now because, I don't know, it has changed. It has changed in the sense that, I mean, there's a lot of wild women around, which is great, which all of which I have access to, you know, like we go around and we're all dancing and howling at the moon and doing all that malarkey. And
they're free.
Free. Witches, yeah, basically. Yeah. And there's a lot of that. There's a lot of wild women. I don't too worry about feminism in rural Ireland. There's a lot of wild women.
That's just Westmeath, though, you know. It's just...
Well, I know Meath, too. There's a few in Meath. There's a few snuck in from Meath.
The houses are bigger, though.
The houses... Outside the pale and inside the pale, I know. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But and I love it. And I have my unofficial animal sanctuary and my sheep. And I still, like, I'm not retired from acting. I'm retired from touring. I'd love, uh-huh. If somebody plopped a lovely grand little, I'll tell you now.
This is the wildness coming out of her.
It's not
God knows where
I
you're
see,
going.
I'm not, because I don't care anymore, you see. Yeah. But anyway, a film that I did last year, a very small film, Blink and You Miss Me, but a really great film called Pete by Paddy Baggett, written and produced and directed by him, has been selected for the Dublin International
Upcoming,
Film Festival.
Yes, in February. Yeah.
So I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled for Paddy. Andrea Irvine who's like, goddess of actresses. Like, I thought, oh God almighty, I'm even sharing the screen with her. God bless us and save us. I've arrived. But anyway, it's a lovely film called Pete and P-E-A-T about Pete.
Watch out for that. Yeah, but who are you in the film?
I'm this, which was great. It was the first time I was ever asked to play somebody who wasn't a mad, crazy, well, she's mad and crazy, but she wears nice clothes and she sculpts the male appendage.
That's what she does.
She does.
She's very free.
Very free, and she has a young lover. And I'm talking 3 minutes of screen time here, but there's quite a bit in it.
Look, Judi Dench won an Oscar for 8 minutes on screen.
I swear to God, yeah. Oh God, yeah. Never give up hope.
Shakespeare in love.
I get a, what do you call
still
it?
Still going in her ages.
I'll get an IFTA yet. You'd never know. I might get an IFTA. Wouldn't that be great?
A big cameo. It's not. It doesn't sound like something you're kind of hankering after.
No.
To be honest, no.
No.
The calendar, by the way, is about. It is proceeds the Irish Cancer Society.
Irish Cancer Society.
People in the area were probably. It hasn't affected you, cancer.
It hasn't affected. Thankfully, but our area was decimated this year. Decimated.
Really?
Yeah. We lost three in the quarter in the quarter of a mile of our road. We lost three neighbours where I knew longer than my own parents because they were just icons in the area, like, right. And then in the wider area, just every 6 weeks you heard of somebody who's got a very bad diagnosis. So and then everybody in the calendar has either recovered from cancer or going through treatment or have had a brush. Now, I haven't had a brush in myself, but I have that thing of losing so many people. And my own beautiful first cousin died only 5 months ago.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah. And
that's a lovely reason behind. this whole
Oh yeah, and everybody got really behind it, and we had Keith Harris, who's a great celebrity hairstylist who had cancer 11 years ago doing our hair, so we were delighted.
What a great job,
John, doing makeup.
Great job on the hair.
Doing the hair and
like we've never seen you before, Mary McAvoy.
Yes.
hello@empowerment.fit, that's an email address to get the calendar, all proceeds. It's £20. hello@empowerment.fit.
You'll buy one yourself now.
I will, of course. I'll give her the donation. Come here, we have to go, Mary McAvoy, but thanks a million for coming in.
Well, thank you for having
me. And safe trip back into the Mad Midlands.
Into the Mad Midlands.
With apologies to all the Protestants out there, Mary McAvoy. Get out. Now let's check in with the snowed-in parts of the country, and I want to go to Martin Hassett. He's in Killinall in County Tipperary. Good morning, Martin.
Oliver, how are you?
Not so bad at all. You work and train with horses, is that right? How are you getting on?
That's right. With great difficulty, but we're managing.
Oh, God. You work where, tell us?
I work in Coolmore Stud, but I have race horses myself and the brother there. We train a few race horses with the family there, so a bit of everything.
Very good.
Coolmore are the paid wages, and the horses are they're a sideline.
Paying the wages of a lot of people down there, Coolmore Stud. It's well known, of course. Yeah. You work there. Are you far away from work, and were you able to get to work this week?
Yeah, no, we're about 7 miles from Coolmore. But look, with the weather warnings, I rang my manager there, Tom Lynch, and I said to him, look, we're probably going to need a tractor to get in and out. And in fairness, I got one of these big John Deere's, or as we call them, Deere Johns, and I'm driving. I've got to walk in and out, put lads out of ditches, brought papers. My brother's just after dropping in a paper there into Esther Lahey in Ballantohor, so we're on the way with another paper to Michael Guinan. So we're trying to keep everything going.
You're bringing supermarket goods and newspapers to some of the people.
Yeah, well, my sister have a shop in Killinall there as well, so she supplies the papers, a small shop, and a bit of bread and milk, whatever. We're trying to keep everyone going. And in fairness to Coolmore, they're no problem, get tractors and just turn up the heating. That's all, drive
on. So give a wave to whatever John Deere is going by your house around Killinall.
Yeah, that's me.
So you got to work yourself?
Yeah, I got to work, yeah. But from the racing point of view, with the horses at home, it was challenging because we were, I'd say, over 2 days without electricity and with no water. Right. And horses, trying to get horses that are ready to run and keep them without killing themselves in stables, and they're getting fresh. So once the walkers came back, they came back there in the evening time. We got the horses on the walker there, and we kept them on it for a couple of hours. They were over from probably 5 o'clock on in the evening up to 9 o'clock, and we mucked them out, and it wasn't simple. Like, and with the you have the other problem then with no electricity, I have my own pump and well, and trying to keep water. And
oh, you're getting water from the well. Yes, you'd be afraid of freezing over, wouldn't you?
Yes, and that's a challenging, as any farmer or horseman will tell you, this time of the year. This is the time that horses will drink water, or cattle will drink water.
And amazing.
It's only now you realise it.
Amazing you can exercise the horse. But Martin Hassett, thanks a million for that. That's Killinall, County Tipperary. We said Mullingar is the coldest part of the country, and the Hill of Uishnock is around there. It's the sacred heart of Ireland. So we're joined on the line by the Hill of Uishnock tour guide, Ruth Illingworth. Good morning.
Good morning, Oliver. How are you on
Not
this
so
very
bad.
Cold morning?
You're on the Hill of Uishnock, I believe.
I'm on the lower slopes of Uishnock. I'm not up on the summit because it's a bit cold and breezy, although it's not actually very breezy, but I can give you a description of what it's like.
Do tell us what you can see.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's absolutely beautiful morning out here.
Wow.
The sun is shining down and there's kind of frost, a bit of snow, not very much snow, but there's snow along the fields, and it's the visibility is just fabulous, and that's one of the things about Uishnock, you know, which was the sacred centre of ancient Ireland, a place of high kings of Ireland, as important in Tara in its own day. But one of the things that Uishnock has is this incredible view across Ireland.
Yes, how many counties can you see from the top?
20 counties and all four provinces.
That's extraordinary. You know, I didn't know that.
Yeah, you don't even have to be actually up on the summit. There are various places on the hill where you can see 5-6 counties at a time. And from where I'm looking, totally blue sky, sun's up now, temperature's beginning to go up. It's about -2 or -3 now. And I can see Looking eastwards, I can see over towards the Wicklow Mountains, Dublin Mountains. There was a guy back in the early 1900s who claimed he could see the O'Connell Monument from Ushnock. Now, I think he must have had exceptional vision.
It was exaggerating a bit. But that's a gorgeous description. Thank you so much, Ruth Illingworth. And I'm glad that temperatures are getting higher now, because I think that orange warning is being lifted at 11 a.m. for the worst affected counties this morning. But that's Ruth Illingworth on the Hill of Ushnock, and Martin Hassett in Killinall in County Tipperary. Thank you both so much.
From the North, text studio, followed by your message to 80889.
And there you go. Some great interviews from the past week. And it is the end of the podcast as you know it. If you've interesting stories and things you think we definitely should know, sure, pop us an owl email anytime at all, oliver@rte.ie. It's as simple as that. Have a great weekend. See you Monday to Friday.